This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 25th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 216 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Sophie Grove.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Faisal Islam, economics editor of the UK's Channel 4 News, to talk about what created the credit crunch and, importantly, why nobody can buy a house.
And it's Carnival today in London. Notting Hill is in full swing, so we'll be tracing the roots of black music in the capital with journalist and author Lloyd Bradley to celebrate.
Finally, we'll be talking to Elizabeth Greenspan, the urban anthropologist, whose new book tells the poignant story of the challenges involved in building new structures at Ground Zero.
That's all to come, plus Tom Edwards will be here with next week's news and, of course, some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. I want it because I don't think that bit lasts long enough. I wanted to put my own bit on the end of it. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, how are you?
Happy weekend. I'm all right. I am, as prefaced in the preface, looking forward to going to the Notting Hill Carnival, possibly later, maybe tomorrow.
I know we're sort of missing out a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
But we're not far.
We're sheltering from the rain / sun inside the eerie, spooky, chilly confines of Studio One, right?
Pretty cosy, though.
Pretty cosy. It's all right. It's all right. Last week I was in Ibiza. This week I'm back. I'm in one piece. Look at me.
I know,
I'm
one
okay.
piece. Looking, yeah. I saw you tapping your foot one on a Wednesday morning. Yeah, I think the spirit of Ibiza is still in you, really.
Something's still flowing through my veins. It must be this pure sunshine.
It's quite fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it's rather good, isn't it? I hear you're planning a trip to the White Isle.
I am, in September, the end of
the end of the party season.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Finish it when you've come and finished it for them, right?
Exactly.
Right, you need Grove in the house. DJ Grove.
Yeah, okay. DJ Grove with some tunes. But I'm going to be in the north a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Being, you know, just, it's very relaxed up there. It's almost like a lawless island that nobody even sort of remembered to govern. The Spanish kind
sort of rather,
gave
yeah.
up, and so I'll just do what you want.
I know. I wish that we owned. I mean, of course, there is a great British invasion. I wish that we owned Ibiza instead of Gibraltar. Man, well, that would be so much better.
I know. When they say the rock that is Gibraltar, you look at it; it is a rock.
Yeah.
There aren't even beaches.
I know. It's not all it's cracked up to be. But anyway, we don't want to tread on any political toes, do we?
No.
We can do that later on with the Channel 4 News' economics editor and with Lloyd Bradley, who's written this great book about 100 years of black music in the capital. We can maybe tread on some political toes there. We don't need to be doing it in the intro, do we? We've got plenty of time to go, right? So it's all going to be good. What we should do, we should introduce the one and only Tom Edwards. He's got his own theme tune. Which one will they play today? Let's find out.
And now, from London, Camden's king of current affairs, the man who put the eek into Monocle Weekly, the ooh into the news. He once wrestled an angry mongoose. He doesn't sleep. He waits. He's about to open a can of whoop-ass on your week. And it's not even Monday. Undefeated, unflappable, and pretty much unheard of outside of digital radio, it's Monocle 24's news editor, Mr. Tom Edwards.
Let's keep some clapping going.
Drink that in, people.
That's my favourite of all the intros. I'm really glad they played that one.
We should remind people who actually made that. It is another Tom.
It's Tommy Edwards.
It's Tommy Edwards.
Who is he's the announcer at the Chicago Bulls.
Chicago Bulls, yeah.
Yeah. Right, so
he calls the shots there.
Yeah.
He was one of the originators, apparently, of that kind of music as a kind of preamble to sporting events.
Yeah.
He was a pioneer.
Okay.
He still is. He certainly still is.
Clearly.
Would you like to do something like that?
I would love to do that.
Do you think, can you do a kind of passing impersonation of the other Tommy Edwards?
No, that would be, it'd be wrong to do that.
Yeah.
You've got to be, there's a great deal of loyalty amongst all the different Tom Edwardses.
Yeah. So each one sticks to his own individual niche.
Very respectful.
In broadcasting.
You could hear from his words there how much respect he has for me.
Okay. In the introduction, the other Tommy Edwards from Chicago was talking about opening a can of whoop-ass on our weeks. Let's open that can.
Let's open up and see what's inside. Here goes. Let's start with tomorrow. It's the top of the can.
Okay.
Well, this is a kind of a serious story. A radical Islamist cleric, Abu Hamza. His trial begins tomorrow, which is obviously rather serious. He was awaiting deportation for a long time here in the UK. And he's being charged in the United States, of course. Mustafa Kamal Mustafa. That's his real name. A whole number of terrorism-related charges. Training camps he organised allegedly in the US. The abduction of tourists in Yemen. The small matter of calling for a holy war.
Okay.
You know, again, allegedly. Yeah. He denies all of the charges. He was extradited last year after a long, drawn-out process. But it all kicks off in the US. It'll be interesting to watch what happens. We'll remember, of course, some of his, again, alleged acolytes, people like Zacharias Moussaoui, of course, who was involved in the 9/11 plot, Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, all people who attended Finsbury Park and listened to the teachings of Abu Hamza at one time or another.
And that's the actual trial's happening this week. This isn't protracted. We'll hear what happens and they'll get bail and they'll get sent to...
This is the actual trial, yeah.
Okay, what's next?
Well, let's keep it stateside. Middle of the week, Wednesday. If I was to ask you, what would you say one of the most famous sort of campaigning political or human rights speeches of all time would
I would have said it would be I've Dream. I'd have said it's got to be Martin Luther King.
Wednesday, 50 years.
Oh, that's right.
And so there'll be lots of various sort of different occasions, different things marking the event. Barack Obama himself is going to speak at the Lincoln Memorial, of course, site of that famous address. It's the Let Freedom Ring event. Slightly less keen on that, but, you know...
Let freedom ring.
I'll let it ride, yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds a little twee to me.
But it's kind of important.
You won't be buying the T-shirt then.
No, but I think it's important to mark this famous speech. Obviously, there's lots of different anecdotal evidence about he wasn't actually going to use this dream element that he introduced, and one of his sort of friends who was there with him said, you know, go on, doctor, do it. And sort of, you know, goaded him into delivering this thing, which became the sort of seminal address of the whole movement. But lots of interesting events. We'll be taking a look back as well on Monaco 24 at that speech, what it came to represent. I guess looking at the progress or lack of it in some respects, some people might say, in the 50 years since of, equality and equal rights in the US.
And the way that speech, the cadence and the rhythm of that speech has been sort of copied by famous speech writers and rhetoricians. Is that a word? It is now. Hasn't it? I mean, you can see the way that that was delivered is being sort of has been echoed in the last 50 years.
Well, there's such potency, and I guess it's difficult. I mean, we've only ever understood that from looking back. We aren't, with the gift of hindsight, we know what happened to Martin Luther King. We understand the context of his personal struggles, and whether that imbues it with even more, it becomes so heavily loaded with meaning. But as you said, it was so impassioned, and he was such a skilled deliverer of those kind of speeches. There was a lot of stories at the time of other frontline politicians in the US who were sort of blown away by the power that he managed to summon, the kind of rhetorical devices that he used. So its legacy is not just in terms of what it achieved politically, but in terms of the semantics, the rhetorics of American politics, and global politics, indeed.
And that's on Wednesday, and there's going to be special shows on Monaco 24 that people can listen to and check out.
Of course, as always.
The power. What's third on your list?
What have we got time for? One more, perhaps?
Yeah, probably one more.
Well, let's wrap up. This is a kind of a quirky one. This is happening tomorrow. Bolivia's Carmelo Flores is being awarded the title of a special award, Living Heritage of Humanity Award.
They have these in Japan, don't they? These kind of living national treasures, don't they?
Do you find that particularly interesting?
Who is he?
Well, this is the thing, Rob and Sophie. It's not so much what he is as...
Is he from Bolivia?
As how long he's been doing what he does. He's 123 years old.
Wow.
Now, he is technically, at this stage, the oldest
man in
documented
the
human ever to have lived.
Yeah.
It still needs a few I's to be dotted and T's crossed. But 123 years old.
So where does he live, Tom?
So he lives a little outside La Paz, but he lives at altitude. I think that maybe...
Is that one of the secrets to his health, his long life?
Well, that's one of them. Also, potatoes and quinoa. He says it's delicious. And one of the other things that he does, and this is the actual thing when asked directly, what is the single most important thing? He says, my around-the-clock chewing of coca leaves.
Around the clock, even in his sleep?
Well, pretty much, I guess.
Okay.
Just keep a little wad of it in there.
We know what that's all about. That keeps you pretty sprightly.
Pretty alert. Yeah. But pretty amazing that it lasts that long. It's always a bit of a hot ticket, this issue of who's the oldest person. There's some doubt. The Guinness World Records, they're generally regarded to sort of have the final say. They're scrutinising this as we speak.
Are they?
So, yeah. He has a birth certificate and national identity documents that corroborate that. July the 16th, 1890.
Wow, that's crazy, isn't it? I love that.
I just think of, you know, people going to the Old West and...
Yeah,
I don't know, the Boer War, was that going on then?
Possibly.
I don't know.
But Carmelo Flores was there.
Carmelo Flores.
Absolutely.
And sounds like he should be a flamenco dancer and a lady. Maybe he used to be. Maybe that's secret of his
one of his other. He's got kind of two lives in one go. But apparently, Robert's a little bit sad.
Yeah.
In Fraschia, the village where he lives, he's a bit of a loner, it says now. Now, I don't want to be mean about this, but that's kind of inevitable, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he's outlasted everyone. He's outlasted probably his great-grandchildren. Yeah.
Well, one of his sons looks after him. His son's in his late 60s.
Oh, well, so he had some...
There's a couple of people around, yeah. No, he had a wife. He said, but everyone who lived here has died. I'm the only one who's still alive. I don't know how long I'll live. Only God knows. He'll tell me.
I think we should leave it there. I love Carmelo Flores.
It's quite profound.
Philosophical,
isn't it?
It's profound, and it's all too true. And he's how old? 126?
123.
Okay. The Ted Rogers of the Monocle News. Look ahead. Tom Edwards, thank you so much for your triple bill of wonderful news stories. And are we going to plug? Should we say Wednesday, Martin Luther King? 50 years since that speech, check it out.
Absolutely, yeah. Tune in to Monocle 24. I think Monocle Daily will be getting some experts from both sides of the pond to deliver their 2 cents on the subject.
2 cents and 2 pennies worth?
Absolutely.
Okay. I like the way you said pond there. Tom Edwards, thank you very much, as ever, for the news look ahead. Now, we've all heard the story about the credit crunch, and among the fingers of blame pointed at greedy bankers and lots of talk of toxic assets, there's a fair few of us trying to keep up and maybe just tuning out completely. 6 years on from the beginning of the most severe financial crisis in living memory, it's still not an easily definable problem, but from the increased cost of living to the difficulty of now buying a home, it's a problem that's not going away.
Faisal Islam is the economics editor of the UK's Channel 4 News, and his new book, The Default Line, Why the Global Economy is in Such a Mess, holds not only the world banking system to account, but his own industry, the media itself too, to try and understand why a runaway sense of economic optimism had such disastrous results.
And Faisal joins Sophie a little earlier.
Faisal, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you here. The book is quite something. You've really covered some ground. Congratulations in advance. But I'd like to start with your dedication to anyone that was born in the 1980s. You quote C. Harris, "I've got hugs for you if you're born in the 80s. But then you dedicate the book to the incompetence, also the generation of European political leaders born in the 50s and 60s. I was born in the 80s. Is it that bad?
Well, that's a quote from Calvin Harris, and it's a little wink at people. I mean, I see hundreds of them in my day job as a TV reporter covering economics across Europe. Smart people born in the 80s and the 90s who don't have wild expectations for their lives. They care about, you know, the future. They care about the environment. I was so exasperated writing this book, looking at the root canals of incompetence from political leaders. I really felt quite passionate, exasperated that people read and understand what went on so mistakes are not repeated in the future. And so that was what was behind the dedication.
And let's talk a little bit about property, because part of the book touches on that. I mean, it really is a book that uses examples, very human examples of the financial crisis, really. But one chapter, The Housing Trap, looks at the idea of a mortgage, and you spoke to one executive that described it as one of the most toxic assets. Can we look at how dysfunctional you think our economic relationship with property has become?
What we've had, certainly over the past decade to excess, and then over 2 or 3 decades in Britain, in certain European countries, and in the US, so we're talking Spain, Ireland, and maybe Australia and Canada as well, is an understandable relationship with security. After the dot-com bubble and boom in 2000 in America, people kind of lost trust with the whizzy stock market, day trading, things like that. And they went for something that they felt that they could have faith in, that they could trust, that they could see, they could feel, they could touch, they could live in, which was housing. And obviously this stretches back a lot longer than that. And it's natural, it's understandable to think and have faith in that tangible investment. However, that obviously went hugely over the top in the subprime crisis. But what I've tried to write here in regards to Europe is many European politicians, economists and central bankers suggest that we never had this problem in Europe. It was a strange US subprime issue. And what I'm trying to say here is actually across Europe, you see a pattern of tremendous dysfunction in the relationship with property, of people left with mortgages that they could not afford, willingly sold by the financial system and waved through by the regulators. And at the time, it may have made a lot of sense, but that's just based on the short-term thing, because obviously over the longer term, they're left with this huge stock of debt that isn't disappearing. And you see, and this is an international thing, and you see it in Spain, you see it in Ireland, you see it in part in Britain. In Spain, there's stories in there about what I would call Europe subprime, which is the mortgage markets threw money at people that really couldn't rent. You need a year's upfront deposit to rent in Madrid. And so people who couldn't rent were instead offered mortgages, and they were the immigrants from Ecuador and some from Africa, in the most awful way. And they've been left high and dry, essentially, and they're clogging up the courts system and having their flats taken away from them. And they were offered these mortgages by entities that appeared to be like charities. And so what I wanted to do really was, if you like, follow not just, you know, the stories of how these people got mortgages, because some of that's been done already. I wanted to see how, if you like, you could trace back, a bit like fair trade, where did the money actually come from? How did it end up that a new Ecuadorian immigrant in Madrid or a single mum in Barnsley in the UK could get 125% of the value of the house as a mortgage? And I just kind of unwound where the money came from. And so it's a journey that takes me to Northern Bank's securitization department, where they're chopping up and parceling up mortgages, putting them on motorbikes literally, and sending them off to tax havens so that they kind of run off separately. They raise money using football shirts in Africa. So you have a situation where African liquidity, scarce African liquidity that would probably be spent on roads and factories and stuff, is being channeled via this mortgage system into instant negative equity mortgages in the north of England, where you get German bankers. The German banking system was flush with cash, but no, you know, Germans don't borrow money, so it had to go somewhere. Some of it went into the US subprime. Lots of it found its way into Spain and disproportionately fueled the Spanish bubble. And when it went crash, the German, and there's a quote from a German banker who says, when he's challenged by a German politician as to why he's lending so much money into these risky markets, he says, "You've got to go to the disco, but dance near the door." And that's precisely what the German banking system did. And so the debts and the black holes, when the Spanish real estate thing went pop, were left with the Spanish government. They were holding the baby.
I mean, the book is very interesting on unpacking the provenance of some of the most complicated codes of economic conduct that most people don't understand. And at some point, you really look at how politicians have really exploited that and whether they actually understand them themselves. The chapter on quantitative easing is a very fascinating one, just really who's in charge. Can you tell me a little bit about the process of investigating some of those relationships between politics and economics?
So economics is, I mean, fraud is too much of a strong word. I mean, I did an economics degree. I do like economics. But it can be, it's kind of like kryptonite. You know, it's in the wrong hands, it's very dangerous. And not only if you're Superman. I don't know if that analogy works. But it is a brilliant way of analysing some stuff that happened in the past. It's a god-awful way of trying to predict what happens in the future. And so what you get, economics has been used as a kind of scientific wrapper to give credence to guesswork, crystal ball gazing, basically extrapolation. If something's happened, it'll just continue into the future. You know, there's no science behind that. It's just glorified guessing. And an awful lot of economic forecasting is like that. And I've always kind of thought that. What I didn't expect was going into the central bankers that I interview in my day job. I'm a journalist at Channel 4 News. And you get to meet them and interview them, and certain training in economics, you can try and test their parameters. And after after a few years, I mean, I've been doing this job for a decade now, you do begin to sort of work out, you know, how their mind works, how they present arguments. And, you know, they have these economic models, these very complicated economic models. And the easiest way I can explain as to how concerned the average citizen should be that these central bankers and financiers don't know what they're doing is the following, which is the essential model that was running the British economy. And we all know there was a massive credit bubble from the banking system. That model, set of equations, kind of giant Excel spreadsheet, did not have a banking system in it. It did not have credit in it. So how on earth you can begin to manage a credit bubble in an economy when the institution doesn't have a banking system in its model, I don't know. And to add on to that, the way in which they dealt with the financial crisis was through this money printing, which was euphemistically called quantitative easing. The model did not have an input for quantitative easing either. So neither the cause nor the cure could be put into this model. So they're basically flying blind. And in fact, I kind of write in that chapter that they might as well have reverted to their 17th century weather vane, which is what they used when the ships came down the Thames. And if the wind was going in the right direction, they'd know the ships would get there faster so they could prepare the clerks to give out credit.
So Faisal, in the book, you've done a lot of digging around, looking at the very complex origins of our system. Some surprises in there, including an interview with a man that really invented a very complex and brilliant equation, a Czech hippie, really. Give us an insight into that encounter and how central it is to the system at the moment.
So everything about the crisis is about the creation of masses of trillions of dollars worth of credit out of nothing, really. And what enables you to do that is the management of credit risk in a bank. And they don't go around checking each loan and seeing how risky it is and how likely it is that an individual company or individual mortgage holder is going to default. They come up with equations, that probabilities, based on 30 years of data, if you're lucky. And these equations form the heart of the derivatives market. They created the derivatives market. And the guy, if you like, that split the atom is this guy, Mr. Vasicek, Czech guy, that moved to America, a mathematics whiz, under the tutelage of Nobel Prize winners. And he worked out a way, if you like, to measure the risk of a pool of loans. His equation was then used by investment bankers very lucratively to create some of the more complicated, it was the base, if you like, of the more complicated structures, which became very famous in the crisis. Some have argued that it is the equation that felled Wall Street. It was certainly the equation used by, or a derivation of the equation was used by ratings agencies to misrate mortgages. So you have this equation written by this guy, and it's used basically to create credit and to erase risk. But then what I found really extraordinary was this very same equation, and I was told this by a chief executive of one of the biggest banks in the world, is now used and hardwired into the system that calculates the safety of every major bank in the world, the Basel formula. It starts off with Vasicek's formula. So I managed to find Vasicek in San Francisco, who's retired, who's wearing a kind of hippie badge, it's a peace badge, I should say. Lovely guy. And he'd kind of lost touch with everything. Looks at the equation and basically says that the equation as it's used is wrong, doesn't have any relationship to his equation, and in fact seems to skew things and seems to skew, if you like, the banking system towards mortgages and away from investing in businesses that employ people. So if you like, there may be the start of an explanation as to why our systems, our banking systems in Europe and America, so kind of obsessed with property bubbles and create property bubbles and don't invest sufficiently in businesses. Now, there's a long way to prove that point, but there's a start in beginning to explain some of the things that we see very clearly in the economy right now. And he got quite annoyed about it. He got quite annoyed about what they'd done to his equation. So they should perhaps have a word with him.
The Yoda of derivatives.
He's the Yoda of derivatives, or alternatively, the guy that, you know, the Einstein. He split the atom, and then the bankers kind of weaponized it, is the way that I put it. But he has some wise words to tell all of the Luke Skywalkers and Darth Vaders of the banking system.
That was Faisal Islam talking to Sophie. We're going to check out the musical sounds of London in a moment. We'll be back after this.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the Weekend Edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Sophie Grove.
Today, the streets of West London are bursting into life for the city's annual Notting Hill Carnival. Since 1966, the event has been attracting up to 1 million visitors to celebrate the best of Caribbean culture, food and music, with booming sound systems taking to the streets.
The story of West Indian music in London is the topic of a new book by journalist and author Lloyd Bradley. Sounds Like London, 100 Years of Black Music in the Capital, looks at the sounds that arrived to enrich and then grow within London's music scene, from calypso to reggae, dubstep and beyond. And he joins us now to tell us more about it. Lloyd, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, glad to be here, thanks.
So the book, it's a thick tome. It sits in front of us. It's a handsome piece of kit. It's necessarily thick, I guess, because it melds society and music together for the last 100 years in London. That, I guess, is the trajectory of the book, isn't it?
Well, when I started writing the book, it was not a music story, essentially. Right. It was a story of people. I think why it had never been told before was people looked at it as a musical story. And when you get all sorts of different music, as you just mentioned, it's difficult to link them together musically, and people tended to box them off. So if you look at it, it's actually the same people that were essentially making the music. You know, there's no difference really between sort of Lord Kitchener and Dizzy Rascal.
Right.
Both about the same age when they were doing what they were doing.
Is there a story, though, about the freshness? I mean, this idea of being fresh off the boat, which Lord Kitchener literally was, off the Windrush. Is there a story about that proximity to your immediate immigration to the country, as was the story in the 1950s, I guess, the early 1950s, which is different to that of Dizzy Rascal, Tiny Temper and the guys today?
Well, I think, yes, there was. I mean, these guys arrived to... It was a real adventure for them, you know. Most of them were little modern teenagers, arrived here, never left home before, this sort of stuff. I mean, Kitch was actually a big star and had been abroad. But, you know, I think the idea was to create their own music here to keep themselves and their fellow countrymen happy. But of course, everything mixed up, you know, because you had the, you know, Jamaicans living next door to Nigerians, living next door to Trinidadians. And so London black music started to form itself as early as, you know, the 1930s.
How political was Kitchener and that crew? Because some of the lyrics that you see are very incisive and very sort of commentaries on society at that time, a really interesting window into their lives as immigrants.
Well, the thing was, Calypso, that's what it was. It was kind of a newspaper. It commented on life, daily life around. It might be sort of casual stuff like who's having an affair with who, or it might be the fact the government had put taxes up, you know, but it was all food for Calypsonians. And when they came to England, it was pretty much the same thing. You know, there's tunes like, you know, there's a song about a guy who gets lost on the underground. There's another one about I was there at the coronation. But what it did do is it showed how immigrants' attitudes changed as they became more in tune with what was going on in London. For instance, you know, the famous London is the place for me from Lord Kitchener says, oh, great, we're here, it's wonderful and all that. And then sort of 5-10 years later, he's making records like If You're Not White, You're Black about racial prejudice. So it always had its finger on the pulse of what was going on.
We're going to play that track now, Lloyd. We're going to play an excerpt from it. This is Lord Kitchener, If You're Not White, You're Black.
Your father is an African. Your mother may be Norwegian. You pass me, you wouldn't say goodnight, feeling you were really white. Your skin may be a little pink, and that's the reason why you think that the complexion of your face can hide you from the Negro race. No, you can never get away from the fact, if you're not white, you considered black.
That was Lord Kitchener, If You're Not White, You're Black. The reason we're playing it is because we're talking to Lloyd Bradley, author of Sounds Like London, 100 Years of Black Music in the Capital. Lloyd, where was that played when it came out in the maybe the late 50s?
That would have been played in dances and ballrooms. It would have got played at West Indian Caribbean parties. Kitch would have performed it. And the thing is, Londoners across the board would have been interested in it. You know, Kitch had, Calypso had quite a large white audience, London base, and they would have been into that because, although, you know, there's a level of residual racism that was always there, as in most Londoners weren't and could enjoy a sentiment like that and appreciate it.
And I'm very interested in chapter three, which is all about South African artists coming over, really exiles from apartheid when it really kicked in the 60s, looking at London as a refuge for that, but also as a place that really developed their style and sort of, I don't know, became somewhere that they could really practice their art. Is that a story that springs up more than just in that South African instance?
Of exiles coming here? Probably not, because there wasn't. I mean, the South African regime was unique as far as, you know, colonies or ex-colonies go. So that was always going to be different. And that it's a unique story in the book and a very, very poignant story. I mean, one of the people who worked with them when they were over here, was saying that, yes, there was racism in London, said, but that was like nothing to these guys. He said, this lady told me, she said, oh, they knew what real racism was, you know. So they were really kind of chilled out and relaxed here and enjoyed themselves and got into making the sort of music that they couldn't make where they were, because it was just, you know, it wasn't the ideal environment. One of their members, they had a white guy, Chris McGregor, in the group, and he had to black up to go on stage with them or to leave and arrive at venues.
Yeah,
I've been told stories about, you know, oh, you need Cuban. Yeah, yeah, I'm Cuban.
Whatever you want.
Yeah.
We're going to play another track. I want to talk about integration, how the music mixed, whether it was a great place to come, whether London was a sort of nexus of all these different people. You mentioned the different people from different islands, different parts of the world coming together. We're going to play Dennis Bavel and the Dub Band, Roots Symphony. And then maybe we can have a little wander about dub afterwards. Dennis Bavel and the Dub Band with Roots Symphony. Lloyd Bradley, we seem like we sort of fast-forwarded quite a long way from Lord Kitchener there for the benefit of our listeners. But tell us about this. The dub was obviously the kind of, maybe it was it always the B-side to the kind of love song, maybe in the Lovers Rock period?
Yeah, I mean, it was a reggae tradition in as much as producers or dancers essentially paid singers per side. So if they had something on the other side, then they didn't have to pay a singer. So they gave them two records. But in sound system traditions, the dub side, the instrumental, was always hugely popular because you'd have singing side. You know, this went back to the 60s. And then the dub side without the vocals or just with bits of the vocals. And if it was a record that was particularly big on that sound system, unique to that sound system, the crowd would sing the song to make it their song. So this became really popular like that, that the vocals would drop in and out and the crowd would take it up. Dennis was a fellow who listened to a lot of pop music. He's a huge Beatles fan. He listened in London, you hear everything.
There's some psychedelia in dub, for sure, wasn't there?
Yeah. But in London, you're exposed to everything. So all sorts of odd different rockisms and soulisms and this sort of stuff crop up in London reggae.
We're going to play another track. This is Soul to Soul. We were doing some revision before you came on, and it was so nice to hear this again. This is Jazzy's Groove.
Well, you know, trust has always meant a lot to all of us, for us to stay together, where one would make a decision and the rest would follow. I don't know, yeah. The way we thought, the way things should be, I guess the way things should go, soul to soul.
I need them.
I don't know, it took us a real long time to get things together, you know, but hopefully we're on our way.
That was Jazzy's Groove from Soul to Soul, the head honcho of which Jazzy B provides the foreword for Lloyd Bradley's book Sounds Like Cool. Lloyd, it's great to hear that again. That was when stuff was getting slick, and that was proper hit single, big album. That first Soul to Soul record was a big record, wasn't it?
Oh, massive. Yeah. I mean, Jazzy is, I think, so central to black music in London. In many ways, he kind of epitomises it, both before and afterwards. You know, the sort of do-it-yourself aspect, taking everything around him and putting it in, you know, and simply reflecting what was going on around him. I love that track, Jazzy's Groove, because it sums up Soul to Soul. It's Jazzy sort of rambling a bit, you know, which he can do. But, you know, it's about...
Did you have to edit him for the foreword slightly? It's a rather handsome piece of writing.
Not, they just sort of polished it up a bit. I mean, he dictated it, you know, it kind of worked out all right. But Jazzy was so central to it. He brought sound system culture into the mainstream. It was all DIY, you know, they were making records long time before they had a record deal, you know, and honing that sound. That's why it arrived fully formed when it did, you know. And so, like you say, so successful. It was chart fodder because they'd been playing it in their dances for ages and they saw what went down well and said, well, put a bit more of that in.
And what's the context to that scene? You mentioned the dances and really the sort of lifestyle that came across in that whole era. Can you give us an insight into how really that evolved and that culture evolved?
It was evolving all the time. I mean, this was kind of the thing that I wanted to make the point that black music in London was one journey, and from Kitsch to Dizzy Rascal. But Jazzy, in the middle of that, was he took the culture that had gone before. He was at his feet in the old school sound system culture, which had been brought over from Jamaica, almost frozen in aspic. It's sound systems run their own dances, promote them themselves, press their own records, sell them themselves, you know, self-contained culture. And he did that and had a eureka moment where he said, well, we're going to make it inclusive, not exclusive, which instead of turning it, you know, keeping it as a sort of late night black scene that is a little intimidating, he said, and it's a great quote in the book where he says something like, we wanted to give it enough edge that people knew they were at a sound system, but at the same time, we didn't want to make it intimidating for anybody. So he balanced that and said, we want to bring white people in. We want to make sure everybody's part of this. He says it's not down to what colour you are. It's about the strength of your character, whether you come in. So he took what was happening in London anyway with children growing up with each other, you know, playing football together, you know, getting into music together, this sort of stuff, you know, and realised it, gave it sort of form because everybody got into Soul to Soul, everybody. But it was obviously a black sound. And that was a real tipping point that it's black pop music for the first time, you know, because Lovers Rock was, but it more or less stayed in the sound systems and only two or three songs bubbled up and it was still reggae, you know. But this was a new sound, and it was a sound of London. And from that track we just played, Jazzy's voice couldn't be anything other than from London.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you quickly about the commercial side of it. Obviously, Soul to Soul, big band, they made their money. I wanted to ask you about, it seems, the story of black music in London and the music that was in Jamaica as well, in the Caribbean as well, rather, was people like Chris Blackwell. It was sort of white-owned labels. What I want, and Trojan as well was part of Sanctuary Records, I think, and Virgin even had Frontline Records in there. And I wanted to ask you whether entrepreneurial side of it, not the sound system side, but only labels and stuff, at what point that kicked in?
Well, that was always there. I mean, yeah. The entrepreneurial thing was the sound systems, if you like. They had their own labels. You know, the Lovers Rock label sold hundreds of thousands of singles, but none of them got in the charts because they weren't sold at chart return shops, you know.
So this was kind of when Woolworths ruled the high street in the UK, right? Yeah, and they weren't in there.
That's Price, HMV, all of those places. You had to chart return shops. You know, these were selling in shops that weren't even record shops, you know, grocers and hairdressers and stuff, you know. Anywhere where black people came, they'd sell records, you know. So that worked fine, you know. But what it did was allow the music to develop properly. When you had commercial considerations, essentially, without meaning to be sort of too rude to too many record labels, you had a bunch of middle-aged blokes who probably hadn't been in a nightclub for years deciding what made a good dance track.
Yeah.
You know, and a sort of series of marketing meetings, a massive budget on it already for the video, the PR launch and all of that. But guys like Jazzy just made this stuff and could develop it in its own environment. And so you end up with a thing that, well, we know people like this. We don't need a series of marketing meetings to say this will sell because we've seen the reaction. And that was kind of sound system mentality that came in. And it allowed the Dizzy Rascals, the Jammers, the Kanos.
That was all DIY. They were very DIY when they started, right?
But they did it and just got bigger and bigger and bigger to the point at which the mainstream just couldn't ignore them. So, well, actually, we better have them inside the tent rather than outside.
Lloyd, you brought us bang up to date. We're going to play our last track. It chimes with what we're saying. This is Changuito from Mulla. Today it's Changuito by Mulla. We're talking to Lloyd Bradley, author of Sounds Like London, 100 Years of Black Music in the Capital. And that kind of feels like Dennis Bovell brought bang up today, right?
It's That's pretty much what it is. It's the same vibe, you know. Yeah. Characters are the same people almost, you know.
And I wanted to ask, well, Sophie was going to ask you, when we were listening to that, you were talking off the mic, about which was a good question about American hip-hop.
I was. I mean, it's quite interesting to look at the trajectory and look at that track, sort of taking the sound back to the roots. But I wondered whether America and hip-hop and that whole scene has influenced this very pure London vibe and whether or not some people could think that it's been hijacked slightly.
If they did, they'd probably be wrong that it's been hijacked. I would say that if hip-hop attempted to colonise London, it was beaten back and hip-hop was just taken. I think London got far more out of hip-hop than hip-hop is getting out of London.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing, whether London's given or taken more to this music scene, black music scene, in the last 100 years. It sounds like it's given a lot more than it's taken, right?
Oh, yeah, it really has. I mean, when you start looking at it, I mean, I was doing an event the other night and I played a soundtrack of 30 songs, maybe. And all of them were made in London, and they were all so different, and they were all of London, you know. And it's just, wow, you know, this over 50 years has been given to London, or to the world, actually. I mean, that track you just played by Mulla with, you know, I think he went to Cuba to get some stuff for that, bought it back, and Londonized it.
Yeah, but it's London. You can define the music as London, and the person as a London, and that's the kind of point.
Yeah, and you've gone, you know, from Kitch singing "London is the place for me" on the gangplank of the Windrush to Tiny Temper advising people on how to make a decent cup of tea with London water.
Exactly. And also, yes, exactly. But still a man in a suit.
Yes.
Still a dapper dresser.
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Lloyd, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about the book Sounds Like London, 100 Years of Black Music in the Capital. It's fascinating stuff. But it will totally max out your iTunes account. All the better for that. Thank you so much for coming in.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
We're going to be speaking about the long road to rebuilding Ground Zero just after this.
The site of the former World Trade Center, Ground Zero, will now forever be one charged with emotion. Naturally, the discussion about what to build on the site is one that still stirs passionate debate.
From the relatives of victims caught in the tragedy to ambitious architects and politicians, the past decade has been a struggle to get all voices heard. In a new book, Battle for Ground Zero, Harvard urban anthropologist Elizabeth Greenspan tells the story of that journey. And she joins us on the line from Boston now to tell us more.
Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I wondered first, the opening chapter of your book starts with you walking around or following a filmmaker or screenwriter and then walking around the Ground Zero site. When did you first see the opportunity for writing a book?
I started early on. I was a graduate student in 2001, and I was interested in cities and how they rebuild after war and disaster. And very soon after 9/11, everyone started talking about how should we rebuild and what should we put here. And so very quickly, I started following the news, and by November of 2001, I was spending time downtown in Lower Manhattan and starting to interview people involved in the process.
Elizabeth, can you tell us a bit about the early stages of planning for this very potently loaded site? It's been very ambitious from the word go, really, but what was the master plan and what's emerging there?
Yes. A year after the attacks, there was a huge international competition for a master planner that Danielle Libeskind won, and he mapped the site. So his job was to determine what different kinds of buildings would stand there, from commercial towers to a train station, a memorial, cultural buildings, a plaza. He put all of that together, and then over time, some changes have been made. Some aspects of his plan have been honored. Most recently, the Memorial Plaza opened at the 10-year anniversary of 9/11 in 2011, and that remains open to the public today as the commercial towers surrounding it are still under construction.
You were telling us about Daniel Libeskind's plan for the Freedom Tower and the surrounding buildings. How much of what he wanted and his team wanted has ended up being the reality or is going to end up being the reality, Elizabeth?
Well, it's confusing a bit because when Daniel Libeskind entered the master plan competition, it was the primary job that he was hired for was to map this space. But as part of his competition entry, he also designed the buildings. And so that's why some people may remember seeing his iconic tower that echoed the Statue of Liberty with this asymmetrical spire. And the problem was that his job was never to design the buildings, but he designed them for the purpose of the competition. And so many people saw his plan and thought, well, this will be built, when in fact that was always something kind of extra that the officials asked the competitors to do, knowing full well that those particular designs would never be built. So his master plan, the mapping of the space, has remained relatively intact. There have been some changes. The memorial that he designed was initially plunged into the earth. It was going to be recessed 70 feet below ground, and that's now been brought up to grade. But the general constellation of buildings surrounding the memorial has remained intact, but the designs that he produced have been completely changed. And so his design for the signature tower, Freedom Tower, has not been honored, and the building that they're building today looks nothing like the design that he conceived 12 years ago.
Elizabeth, the book talks a lot about the political battles going on around these buildings. Do Do you think that that is largely because it is such a potent, emotionally loaded site, that the plans in the first place were so ambitious, so symbolic, that they've gone over budget, but also just because people value them so much that things have started to really fall apart when it came to the actual construction of these buildings?
Yes, I think that there was an incredible amount of symbolism and meaning attached, you know, for the people who owned the land and the office space. They primarily wanted to build, or at least their main concern was to rebuild office space and build a skyscraper. But for many others in New York and around the country, the main goal was to build a symbol. And those two projects don't neatly go together. And so that's when everyone started debating exactly what the tower would look like, always had symbolic overtones. And someone was inevitably always upset, and it definitely extended the timeline and, as you said, also caused a number of redesigns that ended up adding to the budget enormously.
You mentioned in the book, Walking Around, that obviously there was the grief comes first, but then opportunity comes after that. Who were the first people? You mentioned flag sellers in that opening chapter. After them, who came in? Because obviously this is an emotionally loaded, but also a place where you can make a name for yourself and make some money as well. Can you tell us some of the personalities that were sort of warring over that space?
Yeah, there were, as you said, there were vendors who were downtown selling flags and banners, and there were hats that said Ground Zero not long after. There were also vendors selling DVDs of the attacks, the imagery that was all over the world after 9/11. And then you also had, in addition to people at the site selling things, you had a different kind of sense of opportunity among architects who lived in New York who wanted to be involved in the rebuilding, both because their city had been attacked and they wanted to respond, but also because this was an opportunity to build something completely innovative and transformative, and they wanted to be involved in that project. And so you saw architects mobilizing very quickly and brainstorming and creating new organizations, all dedicated to the rebuilding of the site.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth. We'll be back after this.
Surf's Up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves. Beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And that's it for edition 216 of the Monocle Weekly. We're going to wrap it up, aren't we, Sophie? We've got a little bit to say, but it's fine. I'm sorry I disappeared during the Faisal Islam interview.
I know, you when heard I the hear... word credit swap default.
I basically, qualitative easing makes me sneeze. I can't even say it.
He is quite something, and that book is just mind-boggling and mind-blowing at the same time.
Mind-boggling and mind-blowing at the same time. And that's maybe the quote that he needs on the dust jacket. You,
exactly.
Sophie,
yeah. I know, he's welcome to it, but it definitely puts you off signing up for a mortgage anytime soon.
Does it? Right.
Yes, rather.
I'll try not to do that then. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Ed Lucas and Elena Falco, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We'll be here again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bounds.
And for me, Sophie Grove.
Thanks for tuning in.